Okay, so let me now move into our talk for the evening. And it's really a follow-up from last time, from last week, which was entirely online. And the theme of the talk last time was bringing our practice to difficult times. How do we bring our spiritual practice to difficult times? And I want to start by just reviewing some of the main points from last time. I think the recording for those who weren't there, as well as for who were there, is, I think it's been posted on the website. But I want to review briefly some of the main points. First is to remember that the traditional training given by the Buddha is a threefold training. It's a training in wisdom, in meditation, and also in what's usually called ethics, bringing it out in one's practice out into the world, into one's community, into one's interactions. In other words, the practice is really designed to be appropriate for all the parts of one's life. And I talked some about how in the West, that's been somewhat lost at times. The focus has been primarily on meditation, to some extent on wisdom, but primarily on meditation, even to the point where groups or even centers are called meditation groups or meditation centers. There's a loss of that sense of the three dimensions, particularly a loss of the ethical dimension. Not a primary focus in most Dharma teaching and in people's practice. And this is a loss, and I think a problem. And so I talked about that some, and how particularly the ethical dimension is the basis for, particularly for how we bring our practice out into all the parts of our lives, out into the world. And it gives us a sense of the importance of really connecting what I called last time, connecting inner transformation and outer transformation. Some of us can be inspired by the figure in the Buddhist tradition of the Bodhisattva, the being who is dedicated to inner awakening, personal awakening, we might say, and helping others. Ultimately, all others. Very archetypal figure in the Buddhist tradition. And really, for me personally, in my own history, I was more of an activist before I became a meditator. And I think I was always clear that I didn't want to give up the outer response to the world and just have inner, although there have been cycles when I was more on one or more on the other. So that's very much the case. But I knew that I wanted to connect them both. And so last time I talked about how grounding more in what we call ethics, sila in the Pali. And ethics is it's not the best word. You know, sometimes it's really about, as one of my colleagues said, it's really about bringing caring and helping into our lives, caring and helping for others as well as ourselves. We probably, most of us know that the five ethical guidelines for lay people are basically variants of not harming. And I think the implied in this is also the more positive quality of helping. So the first guideline is not harming, not killing. The second guideline, not taking that which is not given. The positive dimension of that would be generosity. The third dimension is care with sexuality. The fourth guideline is wise speech. The fifth guideline is care with substances which shift consciousness. And if you were a monk or nun, you would have another 200 or so guidelines, which I will go over one by one in the next half hour. No, just joking. Okay. And so I think for our purposes, particularly important are the first guideline and the fourth guideline for our everyday practice. You know, I invited people who were there last time over the last week to give attention in the flow of daily life to how you're manifesting the ethical guidelines and have the strong intention to follow them. One can practice with the guidelines. Again, meditation helps a lot, but this is really complementary. So you can have the intention, let me follow as much as I can the guideline on non-harming. And try to remember that a few times a day. So it's part of the day. And then the way the guideline as a practice works, we typically might notice, oh, what I just did, was that actually harmful? Maybe in a small way. And we both guide our behavior and we also become more mindful about when we, in a sense, violate the guideline. An important point that I mentioned last time is that the ethical guidelines historically were not just about one's own personal behavior. They had social dimensions. The guidelines were also about what's going on in the community and in the larger world. So, for example, the Buddha gave the interpretation of the guideline on non-harming. He said, let one not destroy life, nor cause others to destroy life. Do you hear that? Nor cause others, perhaps by one's tax dollars. The Buddha didn't talk about tax dollars, but I think implied. Nor cause others to destroy life, nor approve of others killing. That's 2,600 years ago. Do you hear the social dimension there? It's not just about what one does personally. This is a challenging practice, isn't it? If you take it seriously, it can lead one to really question a lot of things. I mentioned also last time some of the ways that King Ashoka of India, of what we now call India, who was a king over a large part of what we now call India, about 2400 years ago, 250 years before the Common Era, one scholar described King Ashoka as developing a moral society of active social concern, religious tolerance, ecological awareness, the observance of common ethical precepts, and the renunciation of war. The king was a Buddhist practitioner, and he actually abolished the death penalty in the society 2,300 years ago. He established medical facilities for all human beings and all other animals. Medical facilities for non-human animals. Interesting, when you apply the ethical precepts, what kind of world do you have? It's powerful, isn't it? When you consider it, what would that be like in our society? he commissioned many officers of the government to work for the welfare and happiness of those who were poor and those who were older. Another way that this social dimension of ethics has been expressed is in much of the work of Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese teacher who I've been privileged to have studied with a number of times. He died in 2022. You know, very powerful being. And you could look, you know, you can look at his guidelines, you know, in 1965, 66, when there was still the war going on in Vietnam, he and many of his colleagues established 14 guidelines, essentially to bring ethical precepts and practice into that society. One of them was, do not kill, do not let others kill. And I think also deeply connected with the ethical precepts is the sense. It was really there very clearly with King Ashoka that the ethical precepts and one's action are designed to benefit all beings. Again, not just some. I think the horizon of our practice, as we have like with metta practice, is all beings. It's not just my neighbors or my family. It's benefiting all beings. This is the horizon of our practice. You know, and I look back at the Metta Sutta, and it begins like this. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. Really a reference to those who are grounded ethically. This is what should be done by those who are grounded ethically and who know the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, bringing in wise speech. And then it goes on, as many of us know, towards the end. So this is the direction of our practice. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded. And then it goes on at the end to say that the person who's expressing metta for all beings is free from the two forms of reactivity. Some of the last lines in the Metta Sutta say, free from hatred and ill will, from the negative form of reactivity, freed from all cravings, from the grasping form of reactivity. It's all interrelated to, you know, the meditation, the wisdom teachings, the ethics. And I remembered a cartoon that I saw, which said, is this really a good way to go? I think it used to be in the Chronicle. I don't know if it's still there. The cartoon called Bad Reporter. Does anyone remember that? Okay. And I cut out a cartoon which said, God's love for all. We could say metta for all. God's love for all. It sounds like socialism. Okay, bringing a little bit of humor, which is very important in difficult times. Yeah. And maybe another time. I didn't prepare for today, but I'll, you know, bring in my clown persona, Guru Garbanzo Bean. Who have I done that here before? No, maybe in August. I think I come back in August twice. And Guru Garbanzo Bean can bring profundity. Okay, no more to say. Okay. So these ethical guidelines, going against what's harmful, the ethical guidelines could also involve repairing harm that's been done. And so some of you, I remember I invited people at the end of the session last time to bring ethical practice in for the week, and a number of people raised their hand. Anyone give some attention to that in the last week? Very good. So we can come back and see what you've explored. You know, and again, I think for me, the two that are most central are non-harming, sometimes not taking that which is not given, and wise speech, which of course is a practice in itself. And maybe I should come back and offer that here more. I think I haven't done that for a while, because, you know, I've been giving retreats on wise speech for 20 years, and it's been a real area of focus. So I talked about the ethical dimension. I talked about the importance in our time of doing inner work with difficult emotions that come up, watching out for becoming numb with all that's there, watching out for taking in too much information as well, which can lead to numbness. So that was a focus. And the importance of the heart practices, metta and compassion, when we're dealing maybe with anger or with sadness or despair. Another area I brought in was maintaining joy in the midst of difficult times. You know, and I remember I did some singing last time. It's in the recording of a song actually from the Jewish Hasidic tradition about Rabbi Nachman of Breslau, who used to say, "Friends, do not despair. A difficult time has come upon us. Our joy must fill the air. We must not lose our faith in living. We must not despair. A difficult time is upon us. Our joy must fill the air." I didn't sing it this time, but some of you may remember. And then lastly, I invited us to listen for what calls oneself, listening for our own calling. What calls me right now in a way that I can help? What can I do to help? It could be 2 hours a week, 5 hours a week. What really calls me? This is from the great historian Howard Zinn. "We don't have to engage in grand heroic actions to participate in progress and change. Small acts, when multiplied by millions of people, can transform the world." So I want to go further now in asking how to bring our practice to the current difficult situation. And one starting point, I think, is bringing our practice and particularly our emotions. I want to start by bringing our emotions to opening to when we hear difficult news. And there's a lot of difficult news happening. You know, and I think I did this once. I've done several training programs for people connecting in or out, and I think we actually had retreats where we meditated, and then a person would give a summary of the news, and we heard the news in a meditative way, you know, with room for what arises emotionally. And I was thinking, you know, of two powerful aspects of the news that I heard that I wanted to share. One of them was, you know, probably many of us know this, is that the termination of most of the work of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has led to many people dying. One person who's a student of this, Brooke Nichols, who's at Boston University, estimated that there have already been over 300,000 deaths around the world related to this decision, not really clearly shown in the news. Another story that's more personal comes from one of my colleagues who teaches retreats with me at Spirit Rock. And she lives in Los Angeles. Her son is married to a woman whose parents came from Colombia in South America. And they came 35 years ago. And their names are Gladys and Nelson Gonzalez. And I wanted to show a picture of them. And so can you see? And they had three children. They've been here 35 years. They had three children. And again, my colleague's son is married to one of the daughters. Here's a picture of the extended family. They raised three children. They have grandchildren now. They volunteered at food pantries during the pandemic. And they led Bible studies at the local church. They engage regularly in efforts to become citizens. The last time they reported to check in to renew their citizenship, they were placed in handcuffs, sent to a detention center near Los Angeles, and then very soon to Arizona, and they were deported. They did not have an opportunity when they were arrested to contact their family. One of the daughters said, "I didn't have a chance to say goodbye. I didn't even know they were going for their appointment." So that's closer to home. Of course, we can multiply that by what? Many, many thousand, right? I think it's good to, you know, for me, feeling that situation closer to home, you know, maybe even you listening to this now, makes it real in a way that's sometimes hard to get just by reading a newspaper or hearing the news, right? So how do we actually get in touch with what's happening? I think we have to maybe each ask that question, because that's, I think that's an important part of practice. I think in deepening our response to what's going on in the world, we can also use really the core teachings. And this is related to the guided meditation. You know, we can see when there's basically greed, hatred, and delusion in the world. The core teaching is that the reason that we are not awake and manifesting metta, and manifesting metta for all beings, is because each of us have greed, hatred, and delusion in our being. Anyone relate to that? Looks like about a quarter of us have that. Okay. Next time I come, some of you will teach, and I will. Okay. And I think it's helpful to be able to see these both in ourselves, but see them in the world as well. And I want to unpack a little bit, because I think a language of talking about greed, hatred, and delusion can be a little bit misleading. Basically, greed and hatred are code for the two forms of reactivity, for grasping after the pleasant and pushing away the unpleasant. And that's really what the issue is. Greed, we could say, would be one form of grasping after the pleasant. And hatred would be one form of pushing away. So when we hear greed or hatred delusion, I think we have to be a little bit careful. It's really about the two forms of reactivity. And then the delusion, which is, again, a synonym would be the ignorance. The Buddha said that the ignorance is the core issue. In a way, greed and hatred are secondary. They're there because there's ignorance, right? And when we don't have ignorance, they don't arise. And especially the ignorance is about assuming that the way to happiness is by grabbing after the pleasant and pushing away the unpleasant. And there are a lot of complexities here, because it's appropriate sometimes to move towards what we want or like and move away from what we don't want or like. But the question is, how can we do it skillfully? You know, and even something pleasant. I think I've told this story before, but one time I was teaching this in a group and I said, the pleasant is not the problem. It's the grabbing hold of the pleasant, the grasping. And I told them, we could sit here and eat cookies the entire evening, and it wouldn't necessarily be a problem. And they said, let's try it. And so we did. We ate cookies mindfully. So there are complexities here. But the larger point is that the ignorance is actually the core issue. And because of the ignorance, we have reactivity. I'll come back to that. Maybe another way to say it is that right at the center of our practice, much as we did in the guided meditation, is the exploration of reactivity. We could say the exploration of greed and hatred. We study reactivity much like we did in the guided practice. We look at moments when we're grabbing after the pleasant, when we're pushing away the unpleasant in all sorts of different ways. And that's central to our practice, isn't it? Noticing how we do that, becoming more mindful, increasingly catching it earlier and earlier. You know, because a lot of our forms of reactivity, particularly at the level of thought, just keep looping and looping. Very true of the judgmental mind. Keeps looping and looping. With our practice, we notice it at the beginning and we don't keep repeating. That's major movement in our practice. That's very much, very much possible. So we look into reactivity. We also look into the teachings about self, what's called not self. We look into that and we particularly notice self-centeredness. Notice that in ourselves. We notice it in others. I particularly notice that in driving. Have you ever noticed self-centeredness in driving? There's a lot of it. Yeah, the Buddha talked extensively about. And so ignorance is particularly not seeing reactivity, not seeing how we construct the self and build it up and grasp onto it, not seeing impermanence. Those are the three main areas of ignorance. So practice, we learn how to see those areas more carefully. This is the Buddha. All of our experience is impermanent. Whatever is impermanent is involved with reactivity. Whatever is involved with reactivity has no sense of self. What is without self, that is not mine, that I am not, that is myself, that is not myself. Thus should it be seen by perfect wisdom as it really is. Who sees by perfect wisdom as it really is, learns not to grasp, and one is liberated. And we can see greed, hatred, and delusion increasingly in the world. Have you noticed that? And this is from the 8th century. This entire world, said Shantideva, who wrote A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, this entire world is disturbed with insanity due to the exertions of those who are confused about themselves. This entire world is disturbed with insanity due to the exertions of those who are confused about themselves. Is that true nowadays? Yeah. And my colleague David Loy was one of the first people who said we can also look at greed, hatred, and delusion and how it manifests socially, how it manifests in the world. We can see greed embodied in aspects of the economic system and in many other ways. We can see hatred institutionalized in many, many forms, all of the isms, you know, in, you know, hatred or reactivity towards certain groups, racism, sexism, homophobia, and so forth, ageism. And it's important to remember with all of these that delusion is really the basis. You know, that all the greed and hatred in the society is based in delusion. And what I also found when I looked more carefully is that when you look at the history, it's the greed for power and wealth is actually greater than the hatred. And actually the greed forms the hatred. We can see this when we look at history. You know, I found this when I worked in the U.S. Congress. It was all about people wanting power, some extent wealth, but especially power. People weren't really interested in dealing with the issues. They wanted power, re-election, and so forth. And I think I've taught here that when I've looked closely at the history of racism, you find that racism and the very beginnings of slavery doesn't come out of hatred. It comes out of greed for wealth and power. And that's repeated over and over again in the history. Just as now, scapegoating doesn't really come out of hatred. It comes out of a strategy to divide and conquer for the purposes of power. That's really important to know, right? That's a way to look at, that's a way to bring our teachings. And so I'll try to finish up just in a few minutes. We really need to, I think, really bring our practice more and more into our responses to the world. You know, to really have a vision. I think that somewhat paradoxically, I think the current time is a chance for people to really say, we want this kind of world. When things are deteriorating, in my view, so much, there can be a sense, what kind of world do we want? Paradoxically, with things getting worse. I think that particularly metta and compassion are particularly important right now, even in the signs that one might use. Compassion for all, or healthcare for all, that's pointing to a different world. And I think bringing metta and compassion into the world really, really crucial now. I think having a vision is so crucial. One of the great yogis of the 20th century, Yogi Berra, said, if you don't know where you're going, you'll probably end up somewhere else. And I brought in Yogi Berra. This is Yogi Berra. When I was a kid, this is about 60 years plus years old. When I was a kid, I lived in DC area and my grandparents lived in New York, and we would go to New York. Yogi Berra played for the New York Yankees, as some of you know. And as a kid, I got to go to the games and I got this statue of Yogi Berra. And it's had a prominent place on my altar ever since. I'll put it right here. See, still in good shape, can stand up. Okay, so in the Jewish Bible, Proverbs, where there is no vision, the people perish. Really staying connected with vision, really important now, even when it seems not so easy to find. Really, really important. See the divide and conquer strategy. Don't be fooled. Really, really crucial. Related to the metta, remember Dr. King's vision of the beloved community. Try to keep manifesting the beloved community locally and then in many ways as we can. I think this is a very concrete way. Like I said, I think metta, compassion, the beloved community is one of the really key ways to manifest right now and point towards where we're going. See what gets in the way of the beloved community in your own life, maybe in Marin Sangha. What gets in the way, if anything, of the beloved community? So I'll finish just with a few quotations. The first is from Winston Churchill, great, great Buddhist practitioner. He said, "Never let a good crisis go to waste." Okay. And then this is from Sayadaw Utejaniya, Burmese teacher. "It's never a question of how to practice if this happens or that happens. Rather, it's always, how do I practice now? That's how you always practice. When I was diagnosed," he says, "with cancer in 2018, I didn't practice any differently than before. Whatever comes, I'm practicing. Things are fine, I'm practicing. Things are not fine, I'm practicing. Always the same way. The practice never changes." The Buddha, "Go forth for the welfare of the multitude, for the happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world." And then I'll close remembering Joanna Macy's teaching. She talks about the great turning to a society that's sustainable, that's just. Three ways to act: stop further damage from occurring, number one. Change your own consciousness, keep on practicing, number two. Develop transformed institutions, number three. Stop further damage. Keep changing your own consciousness and that of others. Develop transformed institutions. I'll stop there. So let the talk settle and see what resonates with you, whether there's something to share, something to ask. And by the way, I brought in also Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion, on my altar, near Yogi Berra. Any reflections or questions, either online or And here, can we start with online?
Yeah, I can. In fact, what we did last time was people were able to talk and your thing was loud enough. So we can try that.
Yeah, we can do that. And then we'll start with Vita, and then we'll go to Deborah. Little louder. Thank you, Vita. I'll repeat that for those online. Vita was saying that it felt just a few words, timely. Timely, important, helpful, needed. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Deborah, please.
First, I just want to say thank you so much, Donald, for coming to our Sangha and sharing your years of practice, study, experience with us. I'm very grateful. I did have a chance this week to practice Sila. I come from a Jewish background, and I mostly don't hang out in that, except culturally and ethnically. But there's a group in New York called J Street, and the guy who started that, Jeremy Ben Ami, he used to work in Congress, in the government, not in Congress. Anyway, he was speaking here in Marin County at a synagogue, Rodef Shalom, that I don't belong to. But I invited a friend who's very Jewish, lived in Israel, who does belong to the Sangha, and she didn't know this guy was going to be speaking. And also present was an Israeli journalist. So I invited my friend to go with me to this presentation. And she was very angry and she was very upset because both the journalist and Jeremy Ben-Ami were positing diplomacy and a two-state solution and not. So basically to me, he was giving a very Buddhist talk. Not because of what I just said, but because the way he said the things I just said.
Deborah, maybe if you could kind of come to your questions just to make some room for others. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, I knew this was going to be long. I apologize. My friend was really angry, almost violently so. And I was able to not be reactive. It was such an experience. I was able to stay calm, stay kind, and hear her and give her empathy. And so, yes, I was able to fulfill what you were recommending last Sunday. So I thank you again.
Yeah, thank you so much, Deborah. There's so much there. I actually just 6 days ago had a similar kind of interaction with someone I know who actually was born in Israel, has very different views than me, and how do I listen empathically? And I didn't mention the word empathy. I think it's so crucial now. So thank you for really naming that. You know, empathic understanding can coexist with disagreement. Really crucial point. And empathy is really about tuning into what matters for another person and what the emotions are, what the feelings are. One of the challenges that I find with the whole situation in connected with Israel is something I found in my in several of my trips that were long trips there, is that there's so much a background of trauma. A lot of intergenerational trauma. And actually, I know one person who's a meditation teacher, Israeli, has a project. His name is Miles Kessler, has a project of bringing 15,000 trauma therapists into Israel-Palestine. Really, really powerful project. But there's so much trauma there, and it's when that's there, it's you can't. It's very hard to have real dialogue. Yeah. And that might be part of the background also. Yeah. Yeah. Please. If you can be loud, so just. Or maybe if it's okay, maybe walk up a little closer. Yeah. 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 It's okay to come a little closer. People might be a little more able to hear. Okay. People online, at least, yeah.
18.
Oh, boy. Okay.
But you don't have to start again. You're just we're talking about really practicing metta.
I'm working with the next. The meditation is to remember time when you felt joy. And then, you know, like we do that, right? Remember a time. I was so upset about what happened. I couldn't remember a single thing. I tried to go back to being a child. Nothing would give me joy. But miraculously, I still had never. Very, very strongly.
Yeah.
And when I was in the kitchen this morning, and my husband said, usually I'm annoyed, but he comes down, he wakes up when I'm ready to get out of it. And it's like, he wants to talk to me, and I want to leave. And it was like, I saw him, and all this meta just rained because I was sitting. I don't know for sure what I think, which is a very sad thought, but I think there's a way. To get around it, to try to use joy as a way to at least deal with things.
Yeah.
So that's what I want.
Yeah, thank you. So really metta and really the importance of almost having like a daily access to joy. A daily access to joy in some form. It could be meditatively. It could be a practice where one looks at flowers. I think I've talked about my practice of appreciative joy, walking around the neighborhood, wishing well for the plants and the trees and the bushes. And for whatever reason, it just opens up a lot. I actually was doing that driving over here. So, you know, but to have one's own practice that connects one to joy, it might be dancing, listening to music. I think really, really, really crucial in this time, right? And to have a way of doing that. And, I was thinking all of those four heart qualities, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. I think they're right at the center of the qualities to develop in both an inner way and then both to share outwardly. Could be a very focused practice to work with those. So let's just sit quietly for about 30 seconds, let it settle, and then we'll shift.